The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 10th of January, 2020. On the podcast today, I have Cathal Frail, CEO of Open Orphan, ORPH ticker there, and Cathal discusses their new 3-year contract with a tier one German pharmaceutical company and progress on their merger with Avivo, HVO ticker there. Plus, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about five things to fear in 2020. Also on the podcast, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both versions of these, top 10 versions of these, at voxmarkets.co.uk. And, you know, if you've seen or received an RNS via the app, which is free, of course, by notification, and you like the content of that RNS, give it a thumbs up on the app. There's a thumbs up little icon there. Hit the thumbs up button, and what happens if it gets enough thumbs up? It'll feature in the top 10 right here on voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Cathal Frail, Chief Executive Officer of Open Orphan, ORPH ticker. Cathal, thanks for joining me.
Justin's a pleasure. Thank you very much for bringing me on.
And of course, that title of yours, Chief Executive Officer, is changing very soon. But what does that mean? I mean, we'll go into it all. In fact, before we do this, Cathal, for people not quite familiar, because it's all changing, you've not been on the market not that long, but lots of going on, lots of news coming out. Describe Open Orphan, if you could. Summarise it.
Open Orphan, Justin, basically, is opportunists to pull together one or two struggling name companies, services companies, make them profitable and sell them on. In other words, do the cleanup of these struggling. We took over Venn, transformed it, eliminated, or in the process of eliminating those losses. We're going to do the same with HVO. It had been worth 170 million market cap 2 years ago. We have opportunities, purely services companies. We're going to stem the losses and later this year sell the entire integrated business to one of the large players. Very simple.
Wow. And I've got to say, you know, you've got to be applauded, because I talk to a lot of CEOs. A lot of CEOs have plans. They talk about them. They have lofty ambitions. And sometimes it doesn't pan out. But you have pretty much been doing what you said you would do. You said you're going to come in and sort of fix Venn. And already you've done sort of, I suppose, four deals that have for Venn. And now you're doing a takeover with Avivo. So let's discuss the last big bit of news then. The 3-year contract with a tier one German pharmaceutical company. That's a good deal, isn't it?
Yeah, look, we're precluded. It'll take us months to get permission, but it's one of the largest German companies. It's one of the largest German pharmaceuticals, so you can guess which one of the two is that. But look, it's a fantastic deal. We haven't said exactly much revenues, but you can take it. It's substantial. That was in the release, the substantial revenues on it. It's a rolling 3-year contract. We did do a similar one before Christmas, where we got the largest French pharma company called Ipsen, converted their ad hoc contracts to rolling 3 years fixed term contracts, where basically Ipsen and our German friends guarantee to purchase a minimum amount of consulting services every month, every year for 3 years. So it's how you transform these companies. You slash the cost base, which we're at, but you increase the bottom line by putting these big rolling 3-year contracts in place that bring real revenue.
Yeah, absolutely. So your plan, Cathal, is it on track? It seems to be to me.
Absolutely. Look, the only one thing, we've had a bit of a share price wobble in the last couple of weeks because people were worried, hey, Cathal's put his net worth, $2 million of his family money into this company. He's very hands-on. He's now moving to executive chairman. And Trevor, who ran HVO, is becoming CEO. Trevor's a fantastic guy to run a pharma consulting business. I'm good at slashing and burning, but guess what? I'm going to be even more hands-on as executive chairman. Trevor will deal with the customers. I'll deal with running the public company, engaging with the market, and making sure we all, shareholders, myself, get out together later this year at a substantial premium to where we are today.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you said that earlier on, you're hoping maybe by the end of this year. Is that right?
Absolutely. Look, we IPO'd in June. We said there's an 18-month roll-up. Let's pick up one or two small consulting companies with no risk, cost plus, eliminate the losses, and seek an exit. And I think we're well on the way there at the moment. Look, our plan is to have this all wrapped up, out, sold before Christmas. Our shareholders get a really good return, and this time next year started all over again with new companies, new sector, new. I think AIM is full of struggling companies, loss making, shareholders sick, sore and tired. Our model is go in, fix them, sell them, go back to go, start all over again.
Yeah. And obviously, the takeover has probably taken up a lot of time, but you've had lots of news out since. Is there more news to come in the next few weeks, months?
Yeah, look, we basically have a good bit of news flow, and then more to come of rolling 3-year contracts, putting them in place. HVivo have a lot of contracts. Hopefully now in the next couple of weeks we'll have announcements there. And really the next piece is now integrating the two companies, make sure the losses are stopped sooner rather than later. And I think the next big one is then let's seek an exit, basically. Along the way, look, people might be worried, we did pre-approve a small fundraise for some stage in January. That will be, I'll be participating in it, institutional shareholders will be in it, we'll be leading it. It'll be a premium to the last round. We're not going to go raise money, and it'll be institutional. We'll only raise enough that we need just to bring the company forward, so it's not going to be a big discounted rights issue of any shape or form.
Excellent stuff. And yes, so it's all looking good, isn't it? And, you know, are there anything now, I mean, you seem very confident, you're going forward here. Like I said, the share prices are dipped a little bit. This is because people that maybe have concerns about the takeover. I mean, is it, as far as you're concerned, before you started this, you had the plan in your head and the way it's going now. Is it exceeding your expectations, or is it just about, you know, keeping up with them?
No, look, we can't believe we've got HVivo. HVivo is a sleeping giant. It almost did 28 million revenue last year. They guided the market early last year to do 28 million sterling. They didn't do it, but all they can say, they've done a substantial amount. It did have 170 million market cap. It burned through 100 million in cash. But HVivo is a sleeping giant. We can't believe we've got it. We've gone exclusive. It's not going away. It's now part of Open Orphan, and basically, well, subject to the final takeover approvals and all that, but that, but when you go unconditional with 86.9% shareholder approval, that's it, as good as done. So well ahead of the game. But again, HVivo had been something we thought on a good day we might be lucky we get it. That now means we don't need to acquire any more companies. We've enough. We've a real business. The combination of Open Orphan and HVivo makes us a serious player. A bit of integration over the coming weeks, a couple of months, and then let's just seek a very realistic exit over the summer months. That's my view at the moment.
Yeah. So when you say you're seeking an exit here, have you been sounding out people already, or companies have been chatting with you, and or as yet, not that stage yet?
No, look, the beauty about both companies, like Venn would have been approached numerous times over the years, and for one reason or another, the board told them to go away. HVivo had been approached when it was 170 million, I gather, numerous times. They told the approaches to go away. We're now making it clear we're not selling today. We've some integration, but we've two beautiful businesses, put them together, and we think there'll be a lot of interest later this summer. The reason we're saying we're selling sooner rather than later, our belief is get in, fix them, turn them around, present them, and there's loads more where they came from, and go back to start all over again. Don't try and do too many deals. We all know one step too far, and that's why we want to do a small bit of fundraising for the end of January. It will be a premium. Let's say we raised the last money at 5.6p. It's led by myself and the other institutions, so we would anticipate it'll be at a premium to the last round. Only as much as we need. We don't need a huge amount of money. And then the next big transaction is, can we get an exit before the end of the summer? But certainly at the latest, at the turn of the year.
Lovely stuff. Okay, Cahill, three reasons then. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're talking about, but are not yet following the stories, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Probably the first reason is the management team of Open Orphan and founders, myself. We have 35% of the company pre this merger, invested ourselves. We're locked up for 3 years. The only way we're going to get our money is sell out. So that's one. we've a defined plan to eliminate the losses and seek an exit. So that's the way shareholders get the money, get real cash for the shares later this year. And third one, I think we've said we're going to do this 6 months ago. We're there. So hopefully the market now judges on our actions that we're almost done. We've 6 months to go and it's back to start.
Marvellous stuff, Cahill. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Justin, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
Yeah, happy new year to you, Justin. I'm well. How are you?
You too, yes. And I don't know when we stopped saying that. I think double digits maybe.
I think about now, to be fair.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'll probably put it aside. But may it be successful and prosperous.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just talking, I find it really hard with the Christmas period to do nothing. You know, we're supposed to switch off and almost shut our bodies down, just keep our mouths open for food, but that's about it. And
I did have some days off for the kids, which was great, but I did a few broadcasts and did a bit of work and did some research and things. I just find it very hard to completely shut down, have to say. I'm the same as you, clearly.
Yeah. So generally, I mean, we're going to go into, you've done an article here, which is very interesting, and it's five things to fear in 2020. But generally at the moment, apart from, you know, Trump taking out a major figure in Iran,
markets have ignored that anyway.
Sentiment's quite positive towards 2020, isn't it?
It is, and I have no problem with that. I mean, last year was a terrific year. The S&P was up nearly 30%. Just about every asset that you could lay your claws on last year did reasonably well. Exceptions, possibly, commodities and UK property funds. But generally, you beat cash last year. You beat inflation last year. You made a positive total return on a broad basis. So I think it's hard to argue. But again, the one of the many sort of behavioral biases that investors need to fight is it's always very tempting to extrapolate what's happened most recently going forward because you think it's going to continue.
Yeah.
And the best example of that is a blog I read from Evergreen Gavcal over in the US. It's very interesting. Please, it's not investment advice if anybody reads it, but it's always a very interesting blog. And they just did a piece pointing out that if you looked at the 10 biggest market cap stocks at the end of each decade, you know, that obviously told you that they were the stocks that had done best in that decade.
Yeah.
None of those groups of stocks performed well in the next 10 years.
Yes.
So if you looked at the end of the 1990s, for example, tech had done incredibly well. And in the 2000s, it was a dog. At the end of the 2010s, it was all Chinese economy, commodity and oil players that were the biggest stocks. And then the Chinese economy disappointed and the commodity stocks were dogs in the 2010s. And right now, well, it's tech again, which is exactly the same as the late 1990s. And so I think it's tempting to believe that we're going to be in a low interest rate, low growth, low inflation world, because that's what we've had for the last 11 years. And frankly, it's what Japan's had for the last 30 years. And the Japanification case is hard to combat. But generally speaking, you know, if you look over the history of central bank money printing, it's generally always led to inflation. So maybe Japan's the outlier and we should be looking somewhere else. So I'm not saying that things aren't going to be great. I'm just saying that, you know, to paraphrase Warren Buffett, speculation is most dangerous when it looks easiest.
Yes.
And I think, you know, if you look at that classic, what was his name? Richard Ray, who was one of the sort of creators of Dow theory. You know, he said there are three phases to a bull market. The first, when confidence returns and people think, oh my goodness, the crisis is over, thank heavens. Mm-hmm. The second is when you actually start to see corporate earnings go up and therefore share prices respond. And the third is what he just called the speculative phase, when it's hopes for this, hopes for that, is what gets things going. And if you think about it, what were the big trends last year? Hopes for a trade deal, hopes for an improvement in corporate earnings, hopes for interest rate cuts. Now, okay, the interest rate cuts came through. The trade deal might be about to be, but then in which case, haven't stocks kind of digested that already? So I'm not saying that any of these five things that I flagged that are, I think, sort of known unknowns or unknown unknowns are going to happen, but if they do, they could have a bit of a detrimental effect. So it's always worth having a look, just because portfolio construction is not just about reward maximization. It's about risk protection and downside protection and trying to make sure that you make the best risk-adjusted returns. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, like you say, I mean, I know the UK stock market has been somewhat depressed because of Brexit a little bit, but, you know, as the stock market is higher, like S&P's done very well, hitting recent highs, you know, the risks go up because valuations are higher than any, and they've got to live up to those valuations by proving they've got the earnings to back them up, you know, so it gets riskier the more, because everyone gets more bullish, and that's dangerous, like you just said, underlined by that speculation is the most dangerous when it looks easiest, you know?
I mean, let's just put it the other way around. If you were to stand next to a shop and it was to say to you, with a big sign in the window, prices up 50% or prices down 50%, which shop would you want to go into to buy stuff?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah? Duh. The cheaper one. Yeah, people want to buy stocks when they've got more expensive, as you just said. So you've always got to be a little bit careful and look at value. And one of the ways in which you can possibly protect yourselves, besides some careful diversification, is looking for value and try and maybe gravitate towards areas that have perhaps done less well and aren't as expensive. Maybe you'll be a little bit more careful with those that look dead easy to make money but have already done very well and could therefore be expensive.
Yeah. And do you know what? Whenever you look at a
company,
which
I think means the UK, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Whenever you look at a company and about investing, you should, you know, look at the basics and just say, okay, let's be very conservative on earnings here. And is this a bargain? Is it a cheap stock? You know, and that's the way forward. If you're just jumping on, you know, rallies, then you're going to get burned because you're not looking, you know, you're not assessing anything,
well,
you know?
Well, if you're just looking at narratives, you're going to jump into things like cannabis stocks, which just absolutely got torched last year. And I'm sure there's an interesting story there somewhere, but I think, you know, I think areas where there's cannabis intellectual property and there's medical product coming out of it, I think is potentially interesting. I think growing cannabis, it's no harder to grow than parsley or cress. So, you know, it's called weed for a reason, I suppose. Yeah. So I don't think actually growing it is that hard. And in a world when there's almost unlimited amounts of capital sloshing about looking for a home, there's going to be no shortage of capacity. So I just think, oh, I'm going to buy a cannabis grower. No, there's just going to be so much competition, so much supply. There's going to have to be an angle to it, and it's going to have to be an intellectual property angle, a medical product, and that might make more sense. But just growing cress, nobody would get excited by that, and I don't think cannabis is too much different, quite frankly.
Other than
it's regulated.
Okay, well, let's go to point number one.
So the five things. So the five things. So the first one, and I guess this was brought home by what's been going on in the Middle East this week, is if you did get a spike in oil prices. Mm-hmm. And oil has actually been pretty calm, given what's been going on in Iran and Iraq, partly because at the moment it feels like the world is awash with the stuff, mainly because of US shale production. But if you look at the data going back 40, 50, 60 years, if the oil price goes up 50% year on year, the economy has tended to slow. And if it goes up 100% year on year, you're almost nailed on for a recession. Now, the good news is that means oil needs to get to at least $90 before we even need to start sweating about it. But if, heaven forfend, there was to be a conflagration or the Straits of Hormuz were to be suddenly blockaded, which is a fifth of the world's oil supply.
Yeah, I heard that stat. I couldn't believe that.
There you go. Yeah, it's a tricky statistic. And it's the US Energy Information Administration that publishes it, so I'm going to rely on it. That would be a potential problem because it clearly, high oil prices take money out of consumers and corporations' pockets in terms of higher costs, and it is not a good thing. So that would be one thing. At the moment, good news is it doesn't look likely, but again, you just don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And that's within, I suppose, that strait you mentioned, 50% of oil goes through there, is within bombing distance of Iran, isn't it? So that's the issue.
Or they can just try and blockade it to a degree. Yeah. I mean, yeah, and then if that does happen, then one hedge possibly could be shipping stocks, because then there'd be more need for oil storage on sea, and the distances that the stuff would be shipped would go up. So very large crude carrier and ultra-large crude carriers could be quite interesting. I mean, there aren't any in the UK, unfortunately. Most of them, they're either Greek, Norwegian or US quoted. But things like Frontline and Scorpio tankers, you know, it would be interesting for people to use as a proxy, just to keep an eye on what's going on in that particular industry, if things do get tricky in the Straits of Hormuz, for example.
Yeah, but that would be a sort of just temporary spike, I suppose. It's not a fundamental change in demand, is it? So
The funny thing is with the oil, with the shipping industry, there is this IMO 2020 fuel emissions regulation that came in on the 1st of January, and that is taking some capacity out of the market because ships either need to be fitted with emission controllers called scrubbers, or they need to, if they don't do that, they're now having to use more expensive low sulfur fuel, which is making those ships less economic anyway. So there is an argument that actually shipping, there's a lot of capacity being squeezed out of the market, after a period when actually there's not been a lot built for the last 10 years, which I know one or two people are getting interested in.
Next one.
So oil prices spiking with the first one. The second one is, if the US and Chinese trade talks do not proceed as planned, it looks as if phase one is pretty nailed down. But who's to say the Chinese don't ignore it? Never know. And who's to say that phase two gets stuck? Because in the end, this issue of intellectual property abuse, where I think America probably does have a case, has not gone away. And if you look at data from the CPB, and you can go onto their website, cpb.nl, it's in Dutch, but it's soon translated into English for you. Global trade flows have been slowing for the last 13 to 15 months, and we need to see that pick up pretty quickly. So now, whether that's because the global economy is slowing, or it's just because of US-China tensions and Korea-Japan tensions and US-EU tensions, you know, all right, America and China may finally get something together, but America and Europe's relationship still seems pretty fraught, as does that between Japan and Korea. But if the US trade China talks drag on, break down, that would clearly be negative, because hopes for a deal have been a big support to equities for the last 12 months, even if the trade data has been terrible.
Yeah, it surprised me. The World Bank came out with, I think, growth of 2.5% next year, or this year, I mean, compared to 2.4% last year. I thought it was going to slow down rather than, I mean, it's not only a tiny markup, they may be inaccurate as well, but I mean, I was quite surprised. At least it's picked up, you know, 0.1%, you know, so.
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, as Buffett says, forecasts tend to tell you more about the forecast than the future.
Exactly, okay. The next one, I think, is probably the most important, I think. Do you think?
It is, and to be fair, that probably links into the first, because if corporate earnings disappoint, we have a problem. Now, you know, oil prices would possibly contribute to that. A trade slowdown would probably contribute to that. Now, I just doing some work, FTSE 100 earnings are basically flat on where they were in 2011. US corporate profits after tax are basically flat on where they were in 2013-14. And in the US, it's been share buybacks that have been generating a lot of the earnings per share growth. So at some stage, you might start to run out a bit of financial engineering wiggle room, particularly if, you know, things like oil and trade start to go wrong. So, to be fair, last year in the US, earnings were up about 4-5%, and the S&P was up 30%. So that comes back to our point on valuation. There's been a big re-rating there. And the higher the rating goes, the higher expectations are, the less margin for error you've got if anything goes wrong. Consensus is for about 11% earnings per share growth in the US this year. In the UK, it's about 8%. That probably does need a bit of acceleration in corporate, in global GDP, as the World Bank's suggesting. Might be helped by a bit of chicanery like buybacks. But yeah, if the E starts disappointing, the P starts going up, and, you know, the multiples start looking less attractive. So that would be a big potential negative.
Yeah, and like you say, all the other factors sort of feed into that. You know, that comes out in the wash in corporate earnings, doesn't it? So, okay, exactly. Next one.
I think this is probably the biggest wild card. Inflation. As we said at the start, we've had disinflation basically for my entire 29-year career in the financial markets. So if you get inflation, everything that's worked in my career, long duration assets like tech, for example, or bonds, and to a degree, you know, equities that don't really have, you know, too much by way of pricing power, none of those things would necessarily work. If you look at the 1970s, when there was rampant inflation, the only thing that worked really well was gold. That protected your wealth incredibly well. Nothing else did. And then you needed to buy stocks that had pricing power, which was generally anything that you stuck down your throat or stuck down the sink. Life's essentials. Now, certainly then, in that environment, you don't want to be in long duration assets. And anything which has got one of these business models where you don't know where a profit's coming from, whether it's Uber or WeWork, whatever, they're going to be worth just a big fat donut. So I think that would be the biggest surprise of all, because it would just be such an out of experience thing for virtually anybody who's working in the market today. So I'm not saying we are going to get inflation, but everybody's written it off as dead, which A, is always interesting, and B, we've still got monetary policy running ultra loose, and we clearly seem to be moving towards a stage when governments are going to start putting their hand in their pocket and end austerity. The UK is moving towards it. The US is already doing it. Christine Lagarde in Europe is starting to badger people to do it. The Koreans are at it. The Japanese are at it. Who's to say you don't suddenly get... And inflation is very psychological. You know, if people are... You know, in Japan, people have clearly become accustomed to it and entrenched to it. Fine. But, you know, you are starting to see wage growth tick up in the UK. You are starting to see it tick up in the US. And unemployment is low. So maybe after a long period when capital has had, you know, the better of the argument, maybe Labour's going to start getting the better of the argument next summer, this decade, and that would change the inflation picture very quickly, potentially, and it's just nothing that's in any factored into anything right now at all.
Yeah, I was going to say, where's that inflation coming from? So you think wage growth and all that? And
I think that was one of the most logical. It's just people start to think, hang on a minute, if prices are going up 5%, I want to pay a rise of 7%. Thanks ever so much. And that cycle then becomes very self-reinforcing. Just like in the last 10 years, to be fair, people, I think, have been content to price themselves into a job. Because, you know, 2007 to 2009, let's face it, was a frightening experience for absolutely everybody. And I think a lot of people have been content to keep what they've got or price themselves into work to make sure that they keep some cash coming in, because that was such a frightening experience. Now it's fading into the background slowly. So at some stage, people might say getting a little bit more aggressive, particularly when interest rates are low. So we will see what happens.
Okay. And the last one?
Well, if inflation starts going up, maybe central banks will be obliged to start tightening monetary policy. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to happen quickly. The Fed is looking to keep interest rates flat this year. It was looking to raise them last year three times and ended up cutting them three times. So, you know, they haven't got a perfect crystal ball by any stretch of imagination. And if rates do go up, that increases returns on cash, increases bond yields, make them a potentially slightly more alternative, attractive alternative to equities. And it also, through things like discounted cash flow models, starts to chew up the valuations of, again, of long duration assets like tech. So again, that would be a big surprise. We've all got used to interest rates basically going one way, which is down or flat for the last 12 years. If there was a change, I think that would be a big shock. I think that's probably actually quite unlikely. The body language and the rhetoric from central banks is now, actually, we're probably quite prepared to let inflation run hot and overshoot for a bit, because it's undershot where we've been for a long time. And again, I think that's something that they'd be very happy to see. And it, because it's, in the end, the global debt is so big. It's now $255 trillion, according to the International Institute of Finance. That's up 65 to 70% from the start of the great financial crisis.
Wow.
We're not going to grow out of that. We're going to need to inflate it away. And that's why I think central banks will be happy to keep rates lower for longer. So that might not be such a big threat, but it might mean that inflation is something that does crop. When it does come, the genie pops out the bottle very quickly and it's hard to get back in. Or in fact, central banks don't even try for a bit.
Yeah. That's the thing, is that you do think, I mean, you know, like Japan, for example, their debt. I heard someone argue they'll just write it off. How can you just write it off? I don't understand.
Well, I guess, I think the argument is that Japan would basically default upon itself, because its debt is generally owned by either the Bank of Japan or Japanese retail savers. The problem that you've got is that, you know, the Japanese retail investor, would their savings would take a big hit from that. So I don't think it's as easy to sound as it is. But it wouldn't be like, say, well, I mean, the UK hasn't defaulted on its debt since the stop of Exchequer under King Charles II in the 1672, I think, from memory. But if the UK were to default on its debt, there'd be a lot of people who own gilts, pension funds, banks, other countries who'd be pretty upset. I think their ownership of Japanese paper is pretty limited, so you could argue that Japan would just quietly go bust, nobody else would lose any money, but it wouldn't do Japan any good, and it would set a very frightening precedent. I can't see it personally, no.
No, I know, it's going to be some kind of contagion there, isn't it? I mean, it can't just be on their own, they'll go into a hole and no one else gets affected, surely.
Well,
there'll be a big ripple, you know?
Yeah, well, people think, well, if they've done it, who's next? And I think that's the thing. I don't think it would be a victimless crime as well. But that's the theory, is that Japan just goes quietly foot upon itself and then just starts again, either with a new currency or whatever. Yeah. I mean, there have been major currency resets in the 20th century anyway, after the First World War and after the Second World War. It's not unprecedented. That's the sort of talk that gets gold bugs very excited, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always good to know the risks, you know. You've got to know the risks.
It's important because whether it's a known unknown or an unknown and all that stuff that Rumsfeld was talking about, because in the end, portfolios are about making the best risk-adjusted returns that suit your personal needs. And when making money's easiest, it's generally when people start losing their risk discipline, taking chances that they wouldn't do normally, and that's when trouble starts.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff.
It's a pleasure.
Something to worry about over the weekend.
Hopefully not. It's just always worth keeping your eyes open.
Exactly. Do you know what? It's when you talk about stuff like this, I always hear almost Warren Buffett coming back to me, because he's always, you know, always very sensible in evaluating companies and sticks to his rules, because he knows there may be sort of rallies where people get crazy and excited. But he understands it happens in cycles, you know, and
it has a discipline. And the interesting thing is, you know, you can look at Berkshire Hathaway, you can look at its quarterly accounts all the way back to dot. And I've got a spreadsheet that just shows the company's cash pile and how it develops over time. And the cash pile gets higher, the stock market goes. And as soon as the stock market goes down, the cash pile goes down. So he invests contracyclically, which is, I believe, what's known as buying low and selling high, which is what you're supposed to do. Exactly. Or in fact, he doesn't even bother with the selling necessarily. He just tries to buy low.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? That's one of the most famous saying of all, you know, is buy low, sell high. A lot harder done, said than done. And you know, it's just emotions.
If it was that easy, we'd all be at home in our pyjamas, you know, living it up, wouldn't we, really? So if it was that
exactly.
easy.
Marvellous stuff. Russ, have a nice weekend.
Have a great weekend.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Metal NRG, which is down 0.93% to 0.53. At four, Lek Oil. Up a smidge, 0.11% at 9.28 pence. At three, GAN PLC, up 3.6% to 173 pence. At two, Pembridge Resources, PERE. It's getting a bit of coverage on social media that people could come up asking me what I thought of it. To be honest, I'm not into resource companies at the moment. I may never be. Who knows? Number one, most followed companies, Ormond Mining, and that's ORM, up 3.45% to 0.75. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At four, oh, it's a form 8.3, Practice Holdings. At four, that's five, by the way, at four, Macango Resources, Macango subsidiary, completes Hypromag investment. At three, Lek Oil, commencement of site survey on OPL 310. At two, Pembridge Resources, third payment of $5.4 million. And number one, most liked RNS, came from Regal Petroleum. That's the Ukraine update, up 8% to 24.3 pence. And they're talking about the Ukraine update there. So that's RPT ticker. That's it for the podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.